I used to like kids like that because it was quite easy to read, if you know what I mean. I'd drive a box with a better kid than a crap kid, because a correct kid, you know what punches, I mean, he was a good stand-up boxer, Gary, wasn't that? And you can read the shots off a good kid, where a novice can get caught with silly shots because they don't know what they're going to do. But a good well-schooled fighter, you know, you kind of know what shots they're going to pick. It's like when you fought like Dean Piffy and Spencer Oliver, people like that. You knew they was going to come correct, if you know what I mean. You get your casual boxing fans. I mean, I know people who are die-hard boxing fans and they know what a journeyman is, and then, you know, they don't look at my record and say, oh, you've lost that many fights, but they know the calibre of people I fought. I thought I was always thrown to the wolves, really, in a way, because that was what my role, that's what it's like when I boxed Spencer Oliver. Once I went the distance with Naz, everyone wanted a better Naz.
Hello, and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tris Dixon.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Holyfield was child's play compared to that one?
I still get goosebumps to this day.
you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's beating me. He's the one that brought him back.
In the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
There's winning, and there's nothing else.
Boxing Life Stories is back, and thank you so much for joining me, Tris Dixon. The 151st guest is 300-fight veteran Peter Buckley, also known to many in the trade as King of the Journeyman. Peter had an extraordinary career, almost always in the blue corner, but he could be a real handful. His life in and out of the ring has been extremely eventful, and it's been chronicled in his autobiography, King of the Journeyman, which is out now. Peter fought a huge amount of champions, contenders, prospects, and finally called it a day on a win with a record of 32 victories against 256 losses and 12 draws. Here we talk about life in and out of the ring, the journeyman subculture of British boxing, and much more. Before we do get to Peter, though, I did want to say a huge thanks to our sponsors, Hanson Lee Resourcing. They continue to be proud sponsors of Boxing Life Stories. Not only do they find you the best people, but they'll help you retain them, and you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance, who are a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide. They provide expert impartial advice for all of your fire, health and safety compliance needs. For more information, look at delcosafety.co.uk. And now here's the wonderful Peter Buckley.
Peter, thank you very much for having us down. Do you know what? It's blown my mind a little bit that I was looking back through your record and I was thinking, like, it doesn't feel like it was yesterday when you had that 300 fight. Mm. And it was obviously on the front cover of Boxing News when I was there. You made the front cover of the Times, and it's actually 13 years ago.
Yeah, nearly Halloween, not my last fight, 2008.
Does it feel like that amount of time's passed?
No, it don't really. It don't seem that long ago, you know, but it obviously was, but seems like it's gone in the blur, really.
And there were offers for a 301st fight.
Yeah, there was, yeah, but
good ones.
I had a few phone calls offering me fights. Like, there was a one in Dubai, but my wife, like, straight away knocked her on the head and said, no, you're not having 301, because OCD, I'd have to have 310 then. So it was a good time to retire, 300, you know.
It's a good time to retire. There aren't many people that have made that.
No, there ain't, but like so I never set out to do 300 fights, that'd be ridiculous. But, and like I say, actually, when I got to 292 fights, I had more or less retired and packed it in. But then I went to a show in Scotland, Tony Ander was fighting for a Masters title, and I was on the top table with Tommy Gilmore as a guest and that. And Tommy happened to say, how many fights did you end up having? I said, 292. And he just said, I thought you would end up having 300 then. And he just planted the seed in my head, and I had a little think about it, had a few drinks up there, and I just decided I'd have eight more fights and just round it off to 300.
It's an incredible story, incredible journey. Before we get to, I suppose, the final chapter there, as it were, what are you doing with yourself these days? Because you've made time for us after a day's work.
Yeah, like I said, I just work now. I've got a job. I work for a removal company. I go around the country, do different clearance buildings and things like that. I enjoy it. I work with some good lads and have a good laugh, yeah.
You've always done bits and bobs, though, even through your fighting days. You were painting, decorating, labouring.
I've done a bit of everything, because like I said, I know a lot of people, and I've done a bit of work here, a bit of work there, you know, so I was always busy, yeah.
What was your first boxing memory?
pro or amateur?
Amateur. Yeah, in life, life as a kid.
My first amateur fight, I remember it really clear. I boxed a kid from Castlevale called Ray Petit. And then I beat him. I got best fight of the night. And then I had my second fight against a kid who was 5-0, who was heavier than me. And my opponent didn't turn up, so they asked me with the boxing. I said, yeah. I lost on the majority decision team. The kid actually went on to get to the schoolboy finals. Lee Williams, his name was, good lad. And then I won my next 19 fights on the trot. Lost to Nigel Wenton in the schoolboy semi-finals. Entered the junior IBAs, got to the quarters, couldn't make the weight. So I was out of that. And then I entered the NABCs when I was 15 and got to the finals there and lost to Mark Tibbs in the final from Repton. And I didn't box amateur again.
He's gone on to become a good trainer as well.
He has, yeah, very good trainer.
How did you lose to Mark? Points?
Points, yeah. I never ever got stopped. Looks like I lost four times out of 54 fights as an amateur. I was really good. And the only person who ever gave me a standing count was Nigel Winter, but I'd never got put over or nothing in any amateur fights. I was a really good amateur, actually, yeah.
What did your parents make of you boxing?
My dad loved it, but my dad was really, you know, keen for me to box. Like I say, I'm from a big family. I'm the youngest of nine. And my older brother done it, David. He had about 25 fights. He weren't too bad. But I was at a club called Talbot, not far from here. New club. And I was there for a few years until I was about 13. Then I moved to an Irish club, Ladywood ABC, the other side of the city. One of my friends boxed for him. And it was a different kind of club to the club I was used to, because the club I was at before, it was like purely a boxing club, like hit, not be hit, where Ladywood was more of a get stuck in and have a fight. And like Frank O'Sullivan, who ran Birmingham City, always said to me, like, he was a better boxer when he was at Talbot, because I used to have more of a scrap when I was at Ladywood. It was that type of club, actually.
Yeah, I boxed for Salisbury ABC, and same thing. It was a tough environment where you had to go in. Pretty much, it was all straight ahead.
Yeah, that's what Lady was like. It was crash bang wallop of it. Yeah.
So when you turned pro, then after a successful amateur career, I guess you were quite ambitious.
Well, no, because like I say, my last amateur fight was 15, and then I was in quite a bit of trouble for a few years and didn't get back into the boxing until I was 20. And there was a pub just down the bottom of the road here, and Rocky Lawler, who used to be Midland Bantamweight champion, he was a good friend of mine. I was in the pub one night, talked to him. He said to me, do you want to come train? And I was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he knocked my door the next day, and he said, come on, are you ready? And I was like, what? He said, come on, we're going training. So I jumped in his car, got my stuff together, went over to the King Stanley where Nobby had the gym. It was an old derelict pub that was going to get demolished. I just started going over there a couple of times a week, and I just got the love back for boxing and started sparring again. And Nobby said to me, then 5 years out, you know, and I was in trouble and that lot, but he said it's kept me fresh, so, you know, because he said you might have been burnt out if you carried on doing your amateur. So, and I had to not learn to box again, but I had to grow back into it, if you know what I mean.
Sure. Mm. Yeah, that 5 year spell, actually, obviously, it's in your book, which we'll talk about a little bit later. You actually went to prison?
Yeah, a few times, yeah, when I was younger. Like I said, I was 15 when I first got locked up.
Were you no good? Were you a bad person?
Yeah, I basically was, yeah. I was always in trouble. I was out robbing cars, fighting, just burgling shops, anything like that, pubs.
What was the longest time that you spent?
I got 2.5 years, but that's for a... Well, when I was 17, I was out of prison. And I was in a park not far from here. I'd done a run on a taxi, me and my mate, and I ended up having a fight in the park, and I got stabbed with a screwdriver and punched my lung, and actually had the screwdriver hanging out my side, and I pulled it out. I collapsed. My mate happened to drag me through a garden, and luckily enough, when he was banging the door, I don't remember much about it. The woman happened to be a nurse, and she got an ambulance for me. And that, and I was in Heartlands Hospital for about 6-7 weeks, and had an operation. And my family was quite shocked, especially my mum, who thought I was going to die in there at the moment. But I came through okay in the end.
Were you touch and go for a bit?
Well, I don't think I was on death's door, but it was quite a bad injury because I had a punctured lung. And like, when I got out of there then, like, I saw myself out early after about 6 weeks. I wanted me to stay in, but I was having none of it. And when I got out of there then, I couldn't really walk nowhere or run nowhere. I was really out of breath all the time. And then I got back in trouble again, and that's when I got 2.5 years. And then I got out when I was 20. And I was more or less out 3 months, and I was pro boxing then.
When so did you make the active decision to change? Did you think, you know, I'm not going to get in any more trouble? That sentence was long enough.
It wasn't really the sentence. It was my girlfriend, who's now my wife, like, more or less give me the ultimatum, like, you know, you either stop going to prison or basically I won't be with you. So it was an ultimatum that works. I'm still with her now, so she's done something right for me, yeah.
Yeah, big thing, right? Yeah, if it's down to her, then you owe her an awful
lot. Oh, I owe her everything, yeah, definitely, yeah, yeah.
So what was the ambition then when you turned pro then? What were you know, obviously, did you know where that, because I spoke to Arv Mitu about this, and he sort of said that he didn't really know where the land lay when he joined Nobby, and he didn't know what he was necessarily signing up for. Did you know what you were signing up for, or did you turn pro with the idea thinking, I can maybe make it to British title level?
No, to start with, I was enjoying the training again. I was loving the training. And it was just keeping me out of trouble, basically. You know, it weren't a bad thing, and I was enjoying it. I was going to shows, and that this was before I was, you know, I had any fights. I was going to shows. I like watching the boxing again. I fell back in love with the boxing. And I didn't think about it. Look, so my first fight, I got a draw. I didn't even know what a draw was, because I'd been to a couple of pro shows, like say, but I didn't know what a draw was. When they lifted both hands up, so I absolutely beat the kid up, do you know what I mean? And when they give it a draw, I've gone, what's happened there? And he's gone, they've given it a draw. I've gone, what's that? He's gone, well, you haven't won and you haven't lost. I'm like, oh, okay. And he said, you can box that kid again next week. And I didn't really understand. He said, box him on one of the run shows next week. But the kid never boxed again, do you know what I mean? I retired him.
See, I bet you did retire a few, didn't you?
Oh, I think so, yeah. Looks like I was just enjoying my boxing, and look, when I first started, I was getting some good results and that, and I was probably putting my head over a little bit, but I was still competitive in that. Look, I mean, I remember going down to down London's Mickey Duff show, and I boxed Chris Clarkson, who was a central area champion and boxed some good lads. And it was a close fight. I thought I might have nicked it, but he got it. And that's what a lot of my fights was. I was getting close fights, I was going the other way, but I was always fighting away from home as well, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and it wasn't too long before you started to get matched against some very good fighters.
Yeah.
The likes of Johnny Bradle and Duke McKenzie early on.
Yeah, well, Nobby asked me about the Johnny Bradle fight. I think Des Gagano or someone like that went and boxed him. And he offered me the fight. Going abroad, I'd never been abroad in my life. And he said, do you want to go to Denmark, fight his kid? I went, yeah. But Nobby pulled a master stroke over there. And like, you don't do 6 2-minute rounds abroad. Well, when we was over there, it was supposed to be 6-3s. And I saw Nobby talk to the timekeeper and going to pointing at his watch. That he was a class. I'd never understood what he was doing at the time. Pointing at his watch and that, and doing like two. I was thinking, oh. So I'm thinking it's 6 3-minute rounds, but at the end of it's 6-2s. I've come back to Nobby. I thought it was 6-3. He's gone, nah, no, don't worry, you'll be okay. I've done the 6-2s with him. It was easy fight. It was quite easy. I mean, I've saw it on YouTube before, and good fight, Johnny Bradle. But I wasn't outclassed or nothing. Never really had me in any trouble and that. And Nobby said, like, yeah, you've done okay there. He said, like, you passed your apprenticeship, basically. Do you know what I mean? And that's when he was matching me with, like, better kids than me, but I was holding my own with them, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I still find it surreal now, obviously, even though I've been in boxing a long time, to hear a journeyman say a fight that they lose is an easy fight.
Well, you can make it as hard or as easy as you can, do you know what I mean? Sometimes you go in there and you next lock up Scotland. I boxed up Scotland numerous times, and you can either make it hard or easy, and, like, you can go in there and have a battle and try and punch the head off him and try and win, which I have done loads of times, and not got the decision. I think, well, I'll just have a move about here and just make it like a spa, and like, you just slow the pace, right? It's only a journeyman can really tell you how to slow it down. Like me and Christian Light used to talk, and he used to say, like, you know, you know, it's like, I mean, I took Christian into fight, and he knew exactly what I was saying to him, because, like, I said, don't, you know, push him back to the corner, tie him up, have a walk around. Just like speaking to myself, basically. You know what I mean? Yeah, so he knew what he was doing, yeah.
Who are some of the journeymen that you've admired over the years? Are there any that really stand out?
Well, I think William Warburton was a very good journeyman. Yeah. A lot better than his record.
Sometimes too good for his own good.
Too good for his own good, because sometimes he'd beat the kid, wouldn't get no work for it. Kevin McCauley, decent, knows his way around the ring, do you know what I mean? I mean, nearly 250 fights. Curtis Gagano, like his dad. I mean, Des Gagano was a fantastic journeyman. I mean, I used to look up to Des when I was younger. Around at the shows, he used to always give me a bit of advice, and, you know, always stuck in my head. Yeah.
Is it a tough gig?
It is tough, because, like you say, me and my wife retire. I've been training some days. I've come home, sat in the kitchen, eating my dinner. The phone's gone. There's a fight going. When? About 2 hours, if you can get to Dudley or Wolverhampton. Yeah, okay, yeah, all right. And is it definitely on? Well, give me 10 minutes, I'll ring you back. And they ring you back. Yeah, the fight's on. So you've been training or you've been to work and whatever, had your dinner, and then you go and fight. And it's always stacked against you. The kid's heavier than me, the kid's bigger than me, the kid's fresh. He's been training for this fight for about 3 months where, you know, I'll probably just come back from work or been training, sparring. I've gone and done that numerous times. I've been in the house and nobby's bibbed the horn. Because I always had my kit ready. Always, I'd come home, my wife would wash my kit, rebag it, and nobby's pulled up those, I'd bib the horn. You get your kit, where we going? London, fighting out. I'd just get in the car, go in the car, fought Marlon Ward, people like ABA champion. I call this like easy fights. Because I wasn't scared of them. And once I boxed people like Duke McKenzie, everything seemed like downgraded after that. Because he was... When I fought the Duke McKenzie fight, I wasn't a journeyman in mindset. I went down there and I was offered the fight with a day's notice. And I just thought, Duke McKenzie, yeah, yeah, flyweight, small, you know, I'm a featherweight, back to superbantamweight. Got a rude awakening, do you know what I mean? But I didn't do that bad for 5 rounds because I wasn't just covering up and all that, do you know what I mean? I was having a go, but he was just too good for me, do you know what I mean? And then give me a bit of a mindset. Well, probably if I would have covered up more, and I might have fiddled my way through and gone the distance, but...
So the Johnny Bradle fight told you that you could survive with these guys, but the Duke McKenzie one told you that you weren't on that level.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Because like I said, Johnny Bradle, quite a competitor. I weren't going to beat him, obviously. It was abroad and that, and good kid. But I wasn't outclassed. I'm not saying Duke outclassed, but he was too good for me. Do you know what I mean? He was just too good. And that's when I found different levels in boxing. Don't forget, I fought loads of European champions over the years, and I always done okay with him. It was just that world level was just that little stepping stone a bit too much, you know what I mean? There was that just that little bit too good for me. The European champions, I held my own with a few of them.
Well, Naz obviously went on to win a world title and you fought Naz. You were first to go the distance.
Yeah,
I was,
yeah.
Well, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me about that, the version of Naz that you got, and did you think that he was going to go on to achieve the stuff that he did?
No, look, so I used to see Naz. He used to come at a lot of the shows with Brendan all the time. Noon, cheeky little... Blade, you know, but he was all right. I got on with him. But when I first boxed Naz, I mean, when I was offered the fight, I was like, I think he'd had 5 fights, 6 fights, all knockouts. I said, yeah, I'll fight him, no problem. And got there. It was at Everton, and he's coming to the ring. I got to the ring first, but I didn't get in the ring. I waited outside, and as he was coming, doing his dancing and all that to the ring, I just sat outside, turned my back to him. You know what I mean? I just looked over. He's got up. He got in the ring before me. I didn't get in until after he got in. But he didn't even flip in. He just stepped in and I just got in then. And it wasn't a hard fight. Like I say, it wasn't a hard fight. He was treading on my toes. I was treading back on his toes. It was more mind games, really.
Did you feel his power or did he not get shots off?
He didn't really get his shots. He didn't hurt me once. And in the second fight, like I say, when I was offered the second fight against him, I jumped through it. It wasn't a problem. I was like, yeah, I'll have it. 8-3s. It was in Cardiff. He was beating me, obviously. He was a bit better in the second fight than the first. But I weren't in no bother, and when the referee stopped the fight, I mean, you could see I was going mad because it was an unjustified stoppage, definitely. I mean, he would have beat me, 100%, but I would have gone the distance with him. He never buzzed me on nothing, I could honestly say that.
Did you have a few of those unjustified stoppages?
Yeah, I did, yeah. I could honestly say I had about 5 stoppages that was genuine. Colin McMillan, that was a genuine one. Paul Lloyd was genuine. Freitas, genuine. Duke McKenzie, twice. But the second one, when I boxed Duke, I had a bad shoulder. Basically, I went there for the money. I never used to read that, but I'd done it a couple of times. I boxed some Mexican once. Can't remember his name. That he was on a showdown somewhere. He was a sparring partner of someone. Took the fight a few hours' notice. I'd been out in the bear in that. I'd been arguing. I weren't in the right frame of mind. I just went down there. I needed a few quid. Done a couple of rounds and I said, Nobby, I'll be hard. Just pull me out. And Bradley, what's his name? Well,
Bradley Price.
I boxed him on the Mike Tyson undercard. Easy fight. He was a lightweight then. When I boxed him up Scotland, I'd been in the car for 6 hours. Got there. He'd weighed in the day before and everything. Someone said to me, I got out the car. It's basically, see the doctor, get bandaged your own first. I was like, oh, fucking, I had nothing to eat. And then someone said to me, heavy ease, you know. I was to him and said, he's a lot heavier than you. He got in the ring and he looked twice the size of that when I boxed him on the Tyson undercard. And I'll tell you, I just weren't feeling it. He hit me with first jab, he hit me, put me square feet, you know, went straight on my arse, caught me with another shot, put me on my arse, then put me down. The referee just caught up. But I wasn't really bothered that fight. So out of the 10, I can only say five are really justified. Look, Richard Everett stopped me. I boxed him three times. He was hitting me with a few good shots. He could punch, believe me, he could punch, but he didn't have me out, or I knew where I was, and yeah, didn't know where I was and that. But I didn't think that fight should have been stopped either.
What was the most frustrating thing, being stopped or missing out on 30 days
of... No, being stopped, definitely, because I'd be... Like I say, the two fights that... Say, three fights, like the one with Jim McKenzie, the second one when I pulled out, I went there for the money, basically, but being stopped hurt me more than the 28-day suspension, yeah, did you?
What, pride?
Pride, yeah, yeah. Because I prided myself on getting the decision. Not as... I'm a tough guy, but I knew how to fiddle my way around, and, you know, I did... People used to say to me, oh, you're tough, you are. I weren't tough. I was clever. I knew how to break the reins down, that, do you know what I mean? Anyone can be tough, can't they? Do you know what I mean?
So when it came to training, because obviously you, I don't know, how, yeah, tell me about your training. Obviously you're active, so active. Were you like a Joey Giardello, a middleweight from the 60s, where you just fought so often that your fighting was your training?
Yeah and no, because I used to run every morning. Every single morning, my tracksuit used to be at the end of the bed.
One pace, you'd do a 5K or...
No, depends. What. If I had a Midland title fight, I'd start off doing 10 mile runs, I'd break them down, then I used to still go to the park over the back of Mons, where I've always used to run. I'd run the park, it's about a 2 mile thing, but I'd do it at a fast pace. Then we had a big hill, I'd do 10 sprints, 10, you know.
Yep.
And I knew how to keep myself fit, and I was always in shape. That's why they phoned me up to do a 10 round fight with a day's notice on more than one occasion. I said, yeah, because I knew I could do the 10 rounds, because I knew I was fit. But I used to go to the gym, and I never used to like doing the bags and that, like I'd skip in, speedball and that. I used to like sparring, and I used to like doing pad work. That's all I used to really like. I mean, people used to say to me, I bet you never spar because you fight. I used to, you know, the officials at the box, I used to say, no, I don't. But I used to love sparring. That was my thing. I used to love having a fight, like, you know, sparring against the lads in the gym, yeah.
What kind of sparring partner were you then? Did you spar the way that you fought? Did you try and fiddle out, or did you have...
No. I never sparred how I fought. No, I always had was a quite... Dingle. Yeah. I had a bit of a fight, yeah.
So tell me about Freitas, Acelino Freitas, Brazilian, who would obviously go on to become a world champ.
Well, look, sir, I used to know a lot of the boxers, you know, look up, study a lot of the boxers.
You were a big boxing news fan, weren't you?
Yeah, big, yeah. I mean, my Mr. Tyre, I used to have piles of them and all, you know what I mean? And when we moved, I left piles of them in the loft. But every Friday, straight around the news, I used to get my boxing news on order. And I used to scrutinise. That's when it used to be really good, you know what I mean? About all the shows, every, you know, describe every fight, really. What weight, what record and that. And Nobby famous said, there's a fight going, some Brazilian. Didn't know his name, Nobby didn't. So I went down to Liverpool. And I was talking to Gary Fornell, who had boxed twice.
Yeah.
And Gary Fornell said to me, you boxed that Brazilian, ain't you, Pete? I said, yeah, mate. He's big, mate. I said, oh, don't worry about it, you know, mate. I didn't think nothing. I hadn't even saw him. And then I'm in the ring, and it's the only time ever, as they've introduced me, he's called, I went to Nobby. That ain't him, is he? And he went, yeah, he's fucking big, he is, you know what I mean? And he went, ah, you'll be all right. Then he got in the ring, and he was big. Compared to me, I was a super bantamweight best, you know what I mean? I couldn't do bantamweight fight, sir. And then the set ran out his record, 18 fights, 18 wins, 18 knockouts. I looked at Nobby like, and he went, hey, you'll be all right, son. And I went, okay. But look, so he come out and he hit me with a left hook, I think, to the body. And it weren't even that it really hurt. It just took me off my feet. He was that big and strong. And I'd done three rounds with him, I think. And I weren't, he was like trying to move a house back. He was trying to push a car. I just weren't getting nowhere. And Nobby said to me, I'm going to pull you out. So I didn't really complain because he was just too big for me, do you know what I mean?
You mentioned Gary Thornhill. What about him and your fights for him?
I had some good fights with Gary. Gary was busy. He weren't really a point. He was very busy. And I used to like kids like that because it was quite easy to read, if you know what I mean. I'd drive a boxer with a better kid than a crap kid because a correct kid, you know what punches? I mean, he was a good stand-up boxer, Gary, wasn't that? And you can read the shots off a good kid where a novice can get caught with silly shots because they don't know what they're going to do. But a good, well-schooled fighter, you know, you kind of know what shots are going to pick. It's like when you fought like Dean Piffy and Spencer Oliver, people like that. You knew there was going to come correct, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. It's like a textbook.
Yeah, yeah.
Spencer Oliver, good?
Good, yeah, good. I mean, I saw Spencer a few weeks ago and we were having a chat. And he was saying to me, like, when we boxed, he said, when I hit you with that right hand, he said, I walked off, he said, I thought, you're out, man, you're out. He said, now I've turned around, I saw you getting up off yourself. Oh, fucking hell. And I watched it that long ago and, like, you think the Fury one's good, I swear to God, you watch it, he hits me with a right hand, I drop on my back, arms spread, give me head a little shake. And you see Spencer walking off, hands in the air, as if like this is over. And I just dragged myself back up. And we have a good fight for four. It was only a four rounder, but it was it was like a world title fight in the down where Basildon or wherever it was like. But
Spencer's career was obviously cut short. Is he one of the guys that you had marked off as a possible champ, world champ?
Yeah, he was a real, I mean, like I say, not many people done that to me, dropped me like that. And for Spencer to do it, like I say, I don't know how I got up from it, but I rated him. I said to Nobby after, I said, he's going places. And he was only saying to me not long ago, Spencer, when I saw him, that was his last fight at Super Bantamweight, that he was killing himself to the weight, then he was going to move up. And, you know, in hindsight, he wished he would have moved up, but I reckon he would have gone on to win a world title, yeah.
Another one who was close to winning a world title but didn't quite get over the line was Michael Brody.
Michael Brody, yeah. Good fighter. I fought Brody, I think, twice as well. Another good fighter, but like I say, I like boxing, because like I say, there was textbook and you knew there was one, two left up, brought up a comeback. And I knew what shots I was going to throw, basically, because it was good fighters, but he was really good, Michael, yeah.
What was your lowest purse?
Oh, my first fight, £180.
180 quid. You still remember that? That's now, all,
yeah, because well, he was. Nobby paid for all my medicals and that. I'd never had to pay for my medicals and all that. Done all that. And then he took a little bit out. I don't forget, I was only fighting on a little two bob dinner show. It's gradually started going up a little bit more.
Who did you make your biggest purse against?
I'd say Hamid, second time.
Okay.
Because they wanted him to knock me out, didn't they? And his next fight, I think he fought for the European title, I think it was.
Was there good money in your 300th?
It was all right for what it was, yeah.
It's also, I suppose, the thing is with that 300, it's given you, it gave you a level of celebrity that you've been able to monetize to an extent with a book and
like I say, I had a book out. Like I say, after my 300,
I don't know if you would have got a book deal if you got 299.
No, I wouldn't have known. No, like I say, after I had my 300 fights, then I had I had State Street Pictures in America get in touch with me. Got a message on Facebook, this is saying, so you want to chat. Oh, I thought it was a wind-up, to be honest. Do you know what I mean? I thought, oh, shut up, man. They've got George Tillman Jr. wants to speak. So I thought George Tillman, he made the biggest Smalls film and that. So I said, he's my number, tell him to give me a ring. And he actually did give me a ring, and I was speaking to him and that, and he was saying, I've read your story in the Washington Post and all this stuff. I was like, oh, yeah. He's going, yeah. He said, I'd love to make a film about you. And it went on for a few years, he said, that I was talking to script writers. They'd done the scripts and that. They sent them over here. I read them. I didn't like it one bit. I said, that isn't me. It's like really Americanized. I met my missus at a barn dance. I've never been in a barn. You know what I mean? And I said this to them. I've gone, oh, no, well, it is. We have to change certain bits and that. And I was like, oh. I said, well, I don't like it. And then they'd done another script, sent that over. And then there was just going about getting funding and all that. And it went on for a few years and then it just faded out. But I still actually, the geezer called Mike Flavin, who was a producer for the company, he works for someone else now, he actually brought my book off me not long ago. He got in touch with me and he said, I want to read your book, Pete. And he said, no, and he sent me the money over that. And I sent it over to him and he messaged me the other week. And he said, oh, great story, he said, do you know what I mean? He said, I wish they would have gone ahead with the film. So
I don't know why they've got to do that to the stories. That even, you know, with the films they've done, that they've turned, you know, from real life stuff into the movies. All the stuff they've taken away is they've taken away the sort of essence of a story. Even with someone like Mickey Ward's and stuff, the stuff that they've created for Hollywood effect, they've taken out some of the best stuff.
Yeah,
to
exactly.
Try and
yeah.
Put in some false narrative.
Well, that's what it was like with this. It's like made out like I got stabbed when I was younger and that. They made out like it was, because I was from an Irish family, they made out like it was an English man who stabbed me and I said, no, it's just, don't sound right. No, it just didn't sound like we was an
it's
Irish family.
Yeah,
it sounded like we was an Irish family getting picked on by English family. It never happened, you know what I mean? So
when you said, obviously, or we said that the Duke McKenzie fight sort of changed your mindset and that's when you sort of became a journeyman. Did that affect your confidence when you started to sort of settle for being in the blue corner? Out of the ring?
Not out of the ring, it didn't, no. It didn't affect my confidence like that, but it's hard because you know. Look, when you go there, you're always two rounds down. It don't matter where you, if you're a journeyman. Anyway, they don't expect you to win. And the referees, a lot of the referees, they look at you like, oh, it don't matter if you don't win because you're used to losing. I mean, there's plenty of fights I've won and I haven't got the decision. And I've looked and I thought, how can you do that? But like we see it time and time again. But yeah, like I say, you have to be thick-skinned. If you start, I never used to slag the referees off. Nobby did, right? He used to give them a the metal medical and all that, right? And I'll just be like,
yeah, for some fights, you probably started four rounds down with not being in the corner.
Well, referees have actually said to me, you would have got won that fight if you were in your corner. They have actually said to me, I mean, Mickey Van Wundt said to me, I was boxing, I boxed Sean Hughes, and I dropped Sean Hughes that, and I won the fight, I thought, but coming out the last round, Mickey Van's got to me, good last round here, like, good last round here, Pete, get a draw. And I had a good last round, he gave it a draw, but quite a few refs said that to me. They said we're going to give you the win. They give me the draw, but them 12 draws I've had, they're 12 wins, because none of them have been in my own town, do you know what I mean?
Have you ever done the stats with your record and gone through each fight and worked out what your actual record should have been if decisions and stoppages?
No, but I know it. I could say 60 fights at least. I could say it's 60 at least where I've lost by half a point and I'm in the away corner. So, you know, against kids who... And I have gone in there and I've had an official move about it. Even though trainers have gone to me, look, Pete, have a move out. We'll give you a little few extra quid, you know what I mean? I've done it numerous times because I knew, one, I wasn't going to get the decision anyway. So I thought, I'll try and get a few quid out of these. And I haven't been hurt. It's like a paid spa to me, really. So, yeah.
Some of the journeymen have got good stories about going on hostile territory and to crowds where you're going into someone's home, a home kid's town and stuff. Have you ever
That was me all the time.
Is that what it was like?
Yeah, I mean...
Are there any atmospheres that stand out where you thought, God, that, you know, I think I want to say that Johnny Greaves was spat at and different things like that. Have you ever had?
I've never been spat. No, to be honest, I've been booed. Obviously, you can get booed and called a fucking prick and all that when you're in the ring, right? But most of the time I've come out of there, a lot of people have got, oh, fair pat on the back, actually. Fair play to you, mate. You're tough. You pushed them all the way and things like that. Do you know what I mean? I've never really had anyone come into my face really threaten me or anything like that. Do you know what I mean? Nothing like that, no.
Have you seen the clip of Tony Booth and Merv Langdale down in Southampton when he hits him with a bolo
punch? Yeah, when he does his Ali shuffle.
I covered that fight for Boxing News. I was there. That was crazy. But he was getting some real stick. They were singing, "You Fat Bastard."
Yeah, I know there was. Yeah.
And then he uncorked this huge right hand. And
I know,
he was
just out, weren't he? Yeah. No, I've been...
And then you could have heard a pin drop.
Don't get me wrong, I've been boxing and people, you fucking prick, and they'll put me head out the ring. I'm going, fuck off, you prick. Things like that. But... Nothing's ever really come about it, like where they've stepped in my face after the fight and nothing like that.
Were you wary of being too good so that the phone stopped ringing?
Sometimes, because like I say, I've had fights where I know I can win. And so like I stopped Matt Brown around. I mean, he went to fight for the British title twice. I stopped him. I didn't think I had a fight for about 6 weeks. Do you know what I mean? And like, why? I've never understood that mentality. Just because you win one fight, don't mean you're going to win the next. Your confidence is what your confidence is anyway. It's like... Sometimes you'll go in, you're really fancy it, and you still don't get the win, but I've gone into fights really fancying it and been up for it. And I've had a good fight and I've lost by half a point where I thought I won that. But other times I've gone in there and I've been in the car 6 hours or 5 hours. I can't think of his name now. He phoned me up to go out to Ireland one day. What's his name? He's Katie Taylor's manager. Brian Peters. He phoned me up once and he's going, can you fight tomorrow? This is on a Friday. I said, when? He said, tomorrow, Dublin. I've gone, yeah, so I'll get you a plane ticket. So I went over on my own, but I've done that numerous times, like Scotland, places like that, because I once went to Scotland and on the train, I was on the train 6 hours, no signal on my phone. And I got off the train, then there was a message off Tommy Gilmore, sorry, Pete, the show's cancelled. So I've gone to Cashpoint, got some money out the bank, got the train back. Tommy sent me down a few quid, looked after me, but... So after that, I used to beckon fly me up there.
Talking about a change of mindset, have you ever had one where you thought you were going to go and give the prospect a few rounds, but he's taken a liberty and you're like, dug your heels in and thought, no, we're having a fight now?
Oh, yeah, I've done that. If you look, say, even with Spencer Oliver there, when he dropped me, he even said to me, I got up and he said, I thought you was out. He said, when I saw you get up, he said, I thought, fuck you now. And we actually went toe-to-toe and we had, especially the fourth round, it was a great round. You know, I weren't going to lie down for no one really, yeah. I still had my pride.
Do you think, or do you see as many journeymen now around as when you were doing it in the 90s and the noughties? Or are you concerned with like the influx of people using Eastern Europeans and Mexicans?
Yeah, like I say, yeah, there weren't that many imports when I was boxing. Like you had a lot of good journeymen, quite a lot. You had the Smith brothers, tough kids, you know what I mean? Like Kevin McCauley was about, Paul Wesley, Brian Coleman, Tony Anna, Cole Taylor, the Ramsey brothers. You know, that's just from Birmingham, you know, from Nobby's gym. We had some great journeymen. I mean, Nobby could take, he stayed plenty of show. We'd go down to Liverpool or Manchester, wherever. Nobby would have six on the bill. Six of us might lose on points, but I guarantee, you want six first round knockouts. It's no good. The crowd don't want to go and see six, 2 hours of boxing. They want to see a couple of hours. So we always give them a good fight in that. And so they knew he was there for the duration.
Were you close to Nobby all the way through your career?
Yeah, I've always gone with Nobby, yeah.
Did he teach you tricks, fouls, everything?
Taught me everything like that, yeah, fouls, how to slip shots. I mean, Nobby, people think Nobby was just used to it, but Nobby, he had a good brain about him. He used to say to you sometimes, look, earn as much as you can without getting hurt, do you know what I mean? And I used to hate coming out with a black eye. I used to do my head if I come home. I didn't used to want to pick my daughter from school with a black eye. It's not everyone knew I'd done boxing, do you know what I mean? They just look at me like I'm a fug. But Nobby knew loads of shit. He taught me how to slip shots and that. I mean, I knew how to slip shots, but I'm on about not block the left hook, walk them back, hold them, hit me in the bollocks, turn them. You learn it as you go along. I didn't have my first fight and knew all that. It's like anything, experience, you gain it. And he used to put me with Paul Wesley, the Ramsey brother, people better and bigger than me, and I'd learn tricks off them, and they'd learn tricks off me. I've said to you before, I learned loads of tricks off you. So I learned tricks off you as well. It weren't one way. Mm. We all learned a little bit off each other because we was all experienced fighters in our gym. We'd all box good kids, so we knew all how to survive and fight.
There were a lot of good amateurs in that gym as well. When you mentioned Mark and Paul and that, they were good amateur fighters as well.
Yeah, really good. Cole Taylor was a good amateur as well.
And you mentioned the Smith brothers. Were you close to Billy and Ernie?
I was more closer to Billy than I knew Ernie quite well. But Billy, when I had my trans license, I took Billy in a few times to fight, you see. And I was really, really shocked because I took Billy in the week before. I took Billy in quite a few times. We'd actually shared a room when I was fighting in Scotland on a few times. And I took Billy in, I think, the week before somewhere. And I was going to take him in on the Saturday or something like that coming up. And Errol Johnson phoned me up and he's gone, have you heard what's happened to Billy? And all I thought he was going to say, he's pulled out the fight. And when he told me what happened, I was really shocked. I was heartbroken for, his family and that, because he was a lovely kid, real nice kid. I used to have such a laugh with him, always had a smile on his face. And you just don't know what's behind some people, and, it was really sad.
Yeah, I think Billy and Ernie are two of the ones that stand out to me in terms of when I think about fighters who maybe have gone there expecting just to go through the motions and have a 4-3s or a 6-3s. But someone's upset them and they've actually stuck their heels in.
I saw Billy beat plenty of good kids. I think he beat Josh Well once. I didn't take him in when I was there, and Josh Well was expected to beat. But Billy went on a little run at one time and he got a good few wins, but he was a tough, tough kid and he could fight. You know what I mean? He could fight.
Why do you think he did what he did? Did he suffer with depression, mental health issues?
Well, I can't personally say what he suffered with, but I know it affects him when his brother committed suicide, thing, and I know it really affected him because I know there was twins, but they was really, really close. Do you know what I mean? So,
have you ever struggled with that kind of stuff?
No, to be honest, I haven't. No, like I say, my wife's always been with me. She's always been, I've got a good family network behind me, and the only time I really suffered with a bit of depression when my mum died about 5 years ago. That was the only time because I was really close to my mum. Used to see her every day. Used to do a lot for her. And I found my mum dead in the house. And that really, really shook me for her. I was in a dark place for a long time, but you ain't got good people around you, you get out of it, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course, time does help.
Yeah, time is a healer, yeah.
Definitely. You still in touch with Nobby now, by the way?
Yeah, I speak to him every now and again, but Nobby's very, he's always been the same. Like, it's like when he used to phone me up for a fight. There's a fight going, blah, 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 boom. That's how he speaks, Nobby, really quick. He'll phone me up. As you, as family, as kids, blah, 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 that. Okay, speak to you soon, mate. We'll go out for something to eat soon. And every now and again, they'll pop over and we'll go out for something to eat. And I won't see him for a few months, but he always phones me up and he's never on the phone for longer than 30 seconds. My wife can tell you that.
Were you a star student, do you think?
Well, I'd like to think I was, yeah, because he used to say to everyone in the gym, like, mind that, we used to have a board in our gym and there used to be names on there who was fighting. And my name was constantly on it. And everyone used to say, oh, Nobby, how come his name's always on the board? He's like, 'cause he never says no to a fight, because I never used to say no. So he used to say to me, like, sometimes someone would turn the fight down and he'd phone me up and say, do you want this fight? I'd say, yeah, sound. He said, do you want to know who it's against? I say, well, if so-and-so was fighting him, I can fight him, can't I? He'd say, yeah. So in the gym one day, whoever turned the fight down, Nobby would be like, you had a good fight the other night, Pete, weren't you? Did you ever fight? Was it a spar? I can't remember. And just whine it in it. And I'd like to think I had a special play, but I think all the Nobby's boxers had a little special place in, I think he treated us all a little bit different, but all the same in a different, if you like, you get what I'm saying.
You know, did you dislike the Losers Limited tag?
Yeah, I did, yeah. I didn't like it. I did. When Nobby was very tongue-in-cheek, you say, and when he was on about this Losers Limited, I was like, no, I'd say we should be called something like Warriors Gym or something. Like, and he was like, nah, fuck him. Because Nobby was like, fuck the system kind of thing, Nobby. Like, you told Nobby to say yes, he'd say no. You know, that's how he was. Yeah. You know what he was like at the show. We used to jump in on the scales and he'd lift us up, you know, our little advantages. And sometimes they'd copy him. He'd say, well, he's only took the fight today. How can you moan about 3 pounds? He's been training for 6 months. Oh, and Nobby used to always say to the kids, like, that's why he used to make me laugh. The kid would come to the corner, you know, centre of the ring. Nobby would say, God, you look fit, son. You look fit. You've been training hard. He'd say, and he'd say to me, like, I've all matched you with him, just like, other kids are like, probably like, fuck, you know, it's like when we used to be doing the pads, Nobby would bang the pads, he'd throw one over at the other side of the change room, he'd go, fuck, you know, you're hitting hard tonight, Pete, I hope you don't hit him that hard. And he was just a character, Nobby, you know what I mean? But you had to know how to take him.
Is it a lonely life being a journeyman?
Because
you're in the blue corner, you're obviously out there on your own, but also you do have like this network where you've got Nobby and you've got the other guys in the gym, so there's a bit of a team as well. And obviously you mentioned your missus here and you've had work and stuff, but do you know what I'm getting at when I say it's like it feels like it's a lonely gig from the outside looking in.
It can be, especially like so I used to go to quite a few fights on my own. If Nobby was, he'd say to me, there's a fight going Saturday, but I'm in Scotland.
Yeah, I guess he spread himself quite thin, having the boys everywhere sometimes.
But with me, you say to me, he knew I weren't really that, but like I'd fly over to Ireland on my own and I'd say to someone, will you take me in? I'd give you 50 quid. I wasn't really scared. I could be lonely then when you're sitting in the hotel room, and so I'd be there up till Monday on my own. But what I'd end up doing, especially if I was in Dublin, like I'd go out to the town centre, I'd end up having a drink, I'd always meet someone there. But when you're sitting in these hotels up Scotland or Liverpool on your own, that and can be a bit lonely, yeah, you're just watching the telly, but it's just work, isn't it?
Did you spar some good boys?
I never liked sparring. I done one, Paul Lloyd once, who actually stopped me in the pros with body shots and that. And I'd been training one day, and he was training in Birmingham with the Lynch brothers. And they said, the phone up and said, does Peter want to do a few rounds, give him a few quid, blah, blah. But I went down there and he cracked one of my ribs, you know what I mean? I thought he was just going to be a spar, but he went on sound on me and he cracked my rib. And I think I got 80 quid. And I thought, I ain't doing that again for 80 quid. Oh, that's not enough. Because it affected me for about a month, probably longer, do you know what I mean? And I thought, I'm not doing that. And I was offered, like, do you want to go and spar with people like Billy Harley? Cole Taylor used to go down to Sunderland, places like that, sparring in London with Duke McKenzie and that. And when Nobby used to offer me, I said, I weren't being beat up for peanuts, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, putting more miles on the clock for less money.
So I'd not... Because all them hard sparring sessions, to catch up with you. I mean, I used to have good spars in my gym with my lads, you know, my mates, basically. And we used to have a little row in that. But I didn't fancy being paid as a sparring partner.
Were you hoping they were going to do a journeyman prize fighter?
I weren't bothered because I'd retired by then. But if they had, I don't think it would have really took off myself, because what would they have achieved? I'm the king.
Do you reckon the journeyman would have had a go?
Oh, they definitely would have had a go against each other, yeah, 100%, yeah. But what would it elevated them to? They wouldn't have got a British talk shot or nothing like that. So would have just been known as what, the best journeyman. But would they have been the best journeyman because they had the best fight in the night? I don't know.
It would have given them a good night, though, wouldn't it?
It would have given them a good wage, probably, and an even playing field, do you know what I mean? That's the only good thing about it. But I don't know. Would I have fancied it? Probably, yeah. I don't know.
You said you hadn't turned anyone down. There had to be someone that you said no to, whether you had the flu, whether you were injured, whether you were like, I don't want to do that one tomorrow. There had to be something somewhere where you've been like,
no. Nah. The only time I didn't fight, I was supposed to fight, what's his name? I fought him eventually. Lebby Lebwana, whatever his name is, the South African who died.
Oh, okay. Ludwaba, yeah.
Yeah. I was supposed to box him once up Scotland, and I was in Birmingham City Centre. I come out of a phone box and some kids tried to mug me with my leather jacket and ended up having a fight and I bust my hand up and I jumped on the bus in town and I come back home and I was back home. My miss, like, I thought he was going to Scotland and I showed him my hand, she was like, fucking hell. I'd phone up and say, look, someone's tried to mug me down. But I never said, I boxed with the flu, I boxed with colds, I boxed after I'd been on the night on the piece, I boxed the morning after I'd been on the night on the piece. And I never said no, never. That's what I could honestly say.
Is there a fight that stands out where you're absolutely hanging, whether you were hungover or ill, and you're like, oh, God?
I've done that a few times, yeah, to be fair. I mean, I boxed once.
Has anyone whinged about you stinking of booze?
Well, Andy, one Saturday, I went to the bookies just down the road, just round there, and I come out of the bookies, and I met a few mates. There's a pub right next to you. They're going to come in for a drink, and I've gone in, I've had a few drinks and that, and I had an argument with my brother's mate and that, and even my dig and that, and I come home, and I fucking had a few more drinks, so I fucking went to sleep, and Andy Mayer's phoned me in the morning. I completely forgot about this fight, because what it was, Oliver Harrison said to me a few weeks before I was in Ireland, and he said to me, I've got this kid, he's green as grass, Pete, will you come and have a move about him? I'll give you an extra couple of quid. He said, he sells a load of tickets. I said, yeah, right. I completely forgot I was fighting the kid. So Andy Mayer's phoned me on the Sunday morning about 10, 11 o'clock. I was in bed, hanging. He phoned me, he was going, Pete, I'll pick it up. I said, what are you on about? He said, you aren't fighting in that show in Manchester or something in the afternoon. I went, today? He's going, yeah. I went, oh, fuck it. And so I'm hanging, mate. He's going, I said, but the kid's only a novice anyway. So he's picked me up. I've got in the car and he went, fuck it, man, you stink a drink. I brushed my teeth, gargle wash and everything. And I honestly don't know how I passed the doctor because I was hanging. And looks like Oliver said to me, just have a move out, Pete, move out, you know. I'll be all right. But the first round, I've hit the kid with a left hook and he's only got in. And Oliver's like, Peter, Peter. And I'm like, all right. And the kid beat me, but the kid shouldn't have beat me anyway because I was really, really holding back. And like, the kid was crap. And I can't remember his name, but I was hanging. But I've had a few where I've been on the piss and looks like I've had a last minute call and like, oh, I've been out last night now, but I'm like, what's the money like? He's like, so I went, all right, do you know what I mean? Like, just have a few drinks of tea and I'm all right.
Do you wonder what would have happened if you got the breaks? Do you ever allow yourself to think how things could have gone?
Yeah, because look, so I watched a fight not long ago, someone sent, people keep coming up with fights I've never even saw of lately. When I boxed Francis Benichou, and he was a former world champion, European champion. And I watched the fight with the sound brought down and that, and he just about beat me. He didn't really even... I remember him saying to me after the fight, I couldn't hit you. Because everything he was throwing out, I could see it a mile away. It was like, you put a stamp on it, and I was just slipping there, cross guard and that. And I thought, I could have competed at that level. I'm not saying I would have won that. But if I would have been put into a European title fight, I wouldn't have disgraced myself, do you know what I mean? I'm not saying a world title fight. But look, so I boxed Harold Gear in Austria for a WBA Intercontinental Bubble, right? And I had 10 weeks training. That's the longest I've ever had for a fight, ever. And I was supposed to be 8 stone 10. I weighed in 8 stone 7 and a half, but me and my wife were telling me, I thought it looked great, you know what I mean? Because I'm slim, my stomach muscles and everything. And it was a 12-round fight, my first 12-round fight, really trained. No beer, no fags, nothing, you know. Proper, I thought, this boy, you know, see what I can do here. And I dropped him in the ninth. It was a competitive fight all the way through, but the ninth round, I dropped him with a left hook to the body, left hook to the head, out. The referees give him a count, walked him back to his corner, wiped his gloves, walked me back to the corner. I'm thinking, what's he doing? And I actually battered him the last 3 rounds, really beat him up. And everyone was saying to me after, I didn't win the fight, but scorecards were a bit wide there, but it was a lot closer. And he fought for a world title after, and he got knocked out in 17 seconds, one of the quickest knockouts. And like I've said before, I'm not saying I would have beat the geezer, but I know, even if I would have got stopped, I wouldn't have got knocked out in 17 seconds. So for him to justify fighting for a world title, I could have fought for a world title and got knocked out, at the end of the first round. I'm not saying I would have, but, you know, it just proves that.
Yeah.
Like Johnny Bredell, he went on to be a world champion. Quite a lot of people who, like Johnny Armour and that, you know, I'm not saying that I could have beat him, but I could have been competitive for 12 rounds with the right amount of notice.
And also, do you think if you'd had a backer, manager, promoter, do you think you would have had to have gone that way with someone else?
Yeah, well, look, say, if I would have gone back amateur when I got out of prison there, and look, so I was a good amateur. After, I might have won the ABA title, then I would have got spotted by a promoter and signed up then. So, who knows? And then I would have been in the red corner. I would have been fighting the journeyman. And your confidence is different then when you've got the right trainer behind you, not saying the right chain, but like the right backing and pushing you to that goal that they want you to reach, you know what I mean? Like, instead of just getting the other move back, or, you know, look, so I won two Midland titles, you know, proud of that, won two Midland titles, fought for a Masters title or a day's notice against Cole Greaves, you know what I mean? Give him a good fight, beat me, but not by much. If I would have had like 6-7 weeks training, you know, who says, you know, notice, who says I couldn't have beat him? He went on to fight for the British title than that. So, you know, I know I was definitely good enough to fight at that level.
Going back to what we were talking about in terms of prospects now fighting a lot of imports and that kind of stuff, do you think in some ways that's stunting some of their developments and by not getting the rounds with people like you and William Warburton and Christian Leight and stuff?
Well, 100%, because like they start believing their own hype, don't they? They think, well, they've had 6 fights, 6 knockouts, but you check the geese record out. English journeymen are the best journeymen in the world, in my mind. These foreigners, that, you know, we made the tough stuff, you know, so, and we've got pride, so. They've knocked 6 kids out, 6 foreigners, Bulgarians, whatever. And then the fight's one who's even half decent. And when they get hit back there, it's shock to the system because they're not used to getting hit. And it's a big shock to them. Like, God, he's just hit me back and he's hurt me. And they don't know how to cope. And you see quite a few times once that happens to them. You can see these kids are always boxing. Every now and again, I'll hurt them with a shot because I could punch a bit, you know what I mean? I put quite a few people over and had a few stoppages on my record, but I could punch quite good. And, once you get stopped in the tracks of that, that's how they learn. They start learning because then they think, oh, I got caught there with a shot. So they start readdressing how the box and that sort. Like Dean Piffey, when I boxed Dean Piffey, I think he'd had about 5 fights, one or more. And he come in, tried to bulldoze me. And I hit him with an uppercut and I split all his mouth. And he looked at me as if, like, that shouldn't be happening to me. I'm ABA champion. What are you doing? You're a journeyman. But, like, there's levels of journeyman. I know I was a good journeyman, you know what I mean?
What does the term journeyman mean to you?
To me, it could mean a few things, but I think someone that knows the game, knows the role more than anything, because we know we're not there to win, but we're there to give them a bit of an education. And if we can win, sometimes, you know, I'll pull out the odd good win and that, and you don't just go in there and cover it. Like I said before, anyone can go in there and cover up and be tough, but you don't. You're not learned of which ones. It's like working a heavy bag, isn't it? So a good journeyman will show you tricks like hit you on the blind spot and have a walk around. I mean, I used to break the reins down, bring it. You don't fight for 3 minutes. You fight for a minute here and then have a walk around. When they come, time up, walk them up. And when you're walking off, and that, I mean, I used to be able to slow the pace right down. A kid come out 100 mile an hour, I'll just stand there and look at him like, and just move my foot from here to there, to there, to there. And they're looking at me like, and they're bouncing, that's all that's there. And all I'm doing, leaving, you know, a little bit of energy here, just move my foot there. I'm using no energy. I'm just moving my foot there, there, there. And they're bouncing around. And after a few rounds, they're fucking knackered.
They're starting to breathe, yeah.
And that's when you start putting a little bit back on them. And then, like, that's how they learn then, when it's like, when they're getting frustrated and that. Do you know what I mean? Who said it before about me? I can't remember who it was. He said there was fighting someone and after the box, mate, Barry Jones, he said, when he boxed me, he said he was frustrated. He said, but when he boxed that Del Jaffe or something like that, the French brother, he beat Dean Piffy. He said, when he boxed him, and he said, I didn't get as frustrated. He said, but I'd learnt that from being frustrated boxing you. He said, because I couldn't get my shots off on you. He said, so when I boxed him, I didn't get frustrated, he said, because I'd been in that situation before. So he had obviously learned that off me. He told me that himself, do you know what I mean? So he'd learned it from me.
Does it bother you that the general public doesn't understand what a journeyman does?
A bit, yeah, because you get your casual boxing fans. I mean, I know people who are die-hard boxing fans and they know what a journeyman is. And then, you know, they don't look at my record and say, oh, you've lost that many fights. But they know the calibre of people I've fought. But the average person in the pub, no, they haven't got a clue. And like, it's just ignorance. It's like, I don't really know about football, but, you know, so it's vice versa.
When you were on the cover of the Times, it should have been in many ways a career high, but it was trashy in the end, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was derogatory. And like, they didn't.
And I felt for Ron Lewis, who I think wrote the piece, because I think the piece was a normal boxing piece.
Yeah.
But obviously the headlines said, what was it? Did it say, like, world's worst boxer?
Something along them lines, but
what did you think when you first picked that up? Or you first
it was a crock of shit, man, because I thought, man, you don't get to 300 fights and the people. I would have been packed in a long time ago if it was the worst boxer. You know, boxers, the calibre of people I box. And if I was getting knocked out every week, every fight, say I had 200 losses, 190 then losses has been lower. Okay, then yeah, fucking hell, mate. Should have knocked it a long time ago, sure. But it weren't like that. But they don't really mean nothing to me, them type of people. It's just tomorrow's cheap paper, innit? Do you know what I mean?
Were you happy with the boxing news?
Yeah, I thought that was great, right? Yeah. Because it was a compliment from boxing people, you know.
Your peers.
That's the word, yeah. And that's what I mean. People who know boxing, like people speak to me who know boxing, they're like, well, what you've done, Pete, fucking amazing. I mean, people who've read my book have gone like, you know, it's given me an insight. People who don't really know about boxing, it's given me an insight to what I actually done. And they've actually messaged me, people who know me from around here and other people, you know, wherever, and they've gone, God, what you done? I found amazing how you boxed him at a day. And they start to understand why you've lost them fights, because they don't know that I've only took the fight at 3 hours' notice and this kid's been training 3 months. They don't know that. All they see is result, lost points. They don't know the background to anything. So now, by reading the book, some people do, obviously, but some people who agree, but that don't bother me.
And you have ended up with plenty of awards, whether it's belts or services to boxing things and different things like that. There's been plenty of awards down the line.
Yeah.
But I can't see anything in the house.
I've got one in there, that them little jugs up there and that. But
okay.
A lot of my stuff, like, because it used to be at my mum's, everything I've won, used to be at my mum's house, you say, and now it's in the loft, if you know what I mean.
Is it boxed up?
Yeah. But looks like I've won some great awards, services to boxing. I mean, the Joe Bromley Award, or what I mean. When I won that...
That was through the Border Control Awards.
Yeah, like, when I won that, I was really... I mean, Amir Khan presented me with that, I think, and I was really... I just thought I was going there for a dinner with Nobby, and when I won that, because I'd read the list, and I knew what it was about, the Joe Bromley Award. And when I won that, that's what I mean. To me, that was a real, real honour, because that was from boxing people saying, you know, you deserve this award. And that's, when you look at the people who have won it, I mean, not everyone wins that. And, you know, I'm in history for that, yeah, forever.
Yeah, for sure. In terms of your skill level, you were saying, obviously, you think you could have fought, you know, not for necessarily a world title, but against a world level guy. What do you think could have been your ceiling? What, in terms of fights that you could have won? British title? Do you think you could have won a British title?
I think I could have won a British title, yeah. If I had been, I don't like to say this, like, managed the right way. If I had been steered the right way, I could have fought and probably won a British title.
Against the right opponent.
Against the right opponent, yeah.
With everything on your side, as opposed to everything against you.
Yeah, stacked against me. Probably fought for a European title. Looks like I fought plenty of European champions. I mean, I fought the one who beat Spencer Oliver, you know, I boxed him. I boxed a few former European champions, and I've done okay. I was never outclassed. And you're talking, I'm taking these fights at short notice as well, you know. Might have had a week for some of them, 5 days. Never had longer than a week for any of them, or, you know. But like,
was the average 5 to 7 days?
Yeah. Sometimes less. But like I say, I boxed Paul Ingle just after I won my Midland title, and I was fit. And I give Paul a really good fight. I think he only beat me by a point. 2 points, something like that. You know, good fight. I did, but, yeah, but I was competitive the whole way.
Sure.
But the second time I boxed him, I had the flu. That's what I'm saying. I had the flu, and they phoned me up. And for 3 rounds, he absolutely fucking battered me. And I thought, oh, God, come on now. And then he must have fought. But I actually spoke to him after. And then he slowed down. But I say slowed down. Paul Ingle never really slowed down, did he? Because he was picking his shots a bit better, as if, like, well, I'm going the distance here. And he went the distance, and I think it was at York Hall. No, yeah, it might have been York Hall, the boxing. But, and I was in the bar, actually, after. And he said to me, oh, I thought I was going to fucking stop you tonight. And I said, Paul, you don't know how close she was, man. I said, I was fucked, man, after 3 rounds. I said, I've been flued up in her. Brought him a pint, whatever, we had a chat. And he went, I thought it was, I said, you need a deal, so I'm glad you took your foot off the gas a bit. He said, oh, fuck me, if I wouldn't have knew that one. Because the steam rolled, you know, man.
Is there a difference between going to a fight, losing a fight, going through the motions, expecting to lose, and throwing a fight?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I threw a fight. I've gone in there and I'd...
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
Because I'm not trying to drop you in it.
Yeah.
But I know when I put this out, when I said originally when we were going to do this interview many, many moons ago, I put out some questions and someone said, have you ever thrown a fight? I'm like, well, I'm sure you haven't ever thrown a fight.
I've not thrown a fight.
Obviously, there's kind of like an agreement, isn't there?
Yeah, that's what it is, an agreement. It's like, the kid, this is what I always say, the kid who you're boxing don't know about this agreement. He don't know about it. The kid who you're fighting don't know that you're going to have a move about it. He don't know nothing about it. His trainer knows about it, or his manager knows about it. They've said to me loads like, Pete, will you come and have, you know, have a move about these kids and all it. You know, he's green as grass, sells loads of tickets, like, but we just, you know, wouldn't see what he's like as well.
Yeah, he needs some rounds.
So you ain't gone in there and threw a fight, but you've gone in there and done, I'll just have a little spar here.
Yeah.
They're probably not going to get a decision anyway. You know, the kid might be half all right anyway, so. But no, I've never definitely thrown a fight. I've gone in there and had a move about it, but I've never, like, thrown a fight, so, like, fell over and this and that, like that.
Go down in the second. One thing I actually ask Arv, and I'd be interested to know your thoughts, is when I talk about boxing and damage through boxing and talk about long-term stuff and whether what now we call CTE, but we used to be punch drunk and everything like that. A, do you have any concerns about that kind of stuff? Do you have...
For myself? Yeah. No, yeah. not one bit whatsoever. Like I say...
Because you seem sharp as a tack.
I am sharper. A lot of people, people I work with, people I meet, they can't believe I had 300 fights. And I can't sometimes, because like, I can remember my amateur shot fights, I can remember fights I had at school when I was a kid. It's like, when I read this book, I've had more sisters ring me up and that, say, they forgot about things what I've done as a kid, and they've gone, I remember that. Hey, you've got a great memory, I really have. I've got, I mean, I can remember.
How's your short-term memory? Is that as good?
Yeah, brilliant. Like I say, it's like, I don't forget nothing, I'm missing to tell you that. But I don't forget nothing, and... Like I said, before my last fight, all my medicals was up, and a week before, I had my brain scan done, you know, my MRI, all that. Everything came. I've never had one movement in all my brain scans in all the years, never one. So as soon as I would have had one, I would have packed it in straight away, because my health would be everything. Even if I would have had one movement, one query, I would never have boxed again, but I never had one. So I went into my last fight, knowing the kid was nothing, anywhere the punch and nothing like that. I drew with him a few weeks before when I beat him. And I knew he weren't going to hurt me. I come out of the fight and no, not one bit of damage on me, no.
When you were, say, 170 fights deep into your career, what was motivating you to keep doing it? Was it just out of habit? It's just the life that you were living?
It was habit, but I did love fighting, do you know what I mean?
Did you get pre-fight nerves and butterflies and that, or did they go through experience? If you went to a big fight or you had a big arena fight, would you be like, wow, this has got the juices flowing? Or was it the same regardless? It was just another day at the office?
Yeah and no, because if I was boxing a real good kid, I'd be switched on. I'd be a little bit nervous, like what you should be. It's like I said before, I boxed John Kay's, I think first or second fight, whatever. I wasn't one bit nervous, right? I was fighting as a kid having his first fight. Big mistake. He hit me with a right hand the first round and he took me fucking head off. And I was like, and then that's, I thought, taking the piss out. I wasn't switched on, and then I switched on, and then I was okay. I didn't respect him as much as I should have, but about one punch made me respect him quicker. Where, you know, if I was boxing the kid, like when I was boxing Spencer Oliver, I knew he was a good kid, so I was switched on, do you know what I mean? And I think that's what made me get from that punch as well, because my adrenaline was still kicking in and I was a little bit nervous and that. It's like when I box on big shows, and when you box on the big show, you know you're boxing a good kid. You know, on these little dinner shows and that, it's just a normal ticket seller. He's a normal kid. He ain't really going nowhere. Might fight for an area title. But when you're fighting these prospects who you're Frank Warren's and, you know,
Barry Hearn,
them, like, you know he's going to be a good kid because he boxed for England, he's won Commonwealth Games, all that. So that nervous... By being nervous, it makes you sharp. So, yeah. But I was never really that nervous of a normal kid, like, if you know what I mean.
Did you ever think that you were sort of... Did you think, in terms of you being a journeyman and experienced, did you think that you were sort of in on the show? Or did sometimes it feel like you were being thrown to the wolves?
I thought I was always thrown to the wolves, really, in a way, because that was what my role... That's what it's like when I box Spencer Oliver. Once I went the distance with Naz... Everyone wanted a better Naz. We can stop Naz. If we can stop Peter Buckley, Naz hasn't done it. You know, it was and I knew that when I was boxing certain kids, I knew they all wanted a, because it's like Nazim couldn't do it, but he done it, so he's got to be a better fighter than Naz. But it don't work out like that, does it?
In terms of being thrown to the wolves, though, like it was it? Did you and we're looking at pre-fight nerves here as well? Was it a daunting thing to go to these occasions and know you're fighting the establishment? Judges, the crowd, sometimes many tens of thousands, and a young, hungry prospect as well. It's just not on your favour, is it?
No,
but did you feel a bit like it stiffened your resolve? It was you against everyone in the building.
Yeah, well, it was my stubbornness that made me get through the fight as well. A lot of it, I thought, all these fuckers booing me and shit. I'll show these. This kid's been training for 3 months, day in, day out. I've had this phone call 2 days ago. Probably was on the beer last week. The crowd's all booing at me. I know the ref's against me. And it was my stubbornness a lot of the time that kept me in there. I thought, you ain't all having a laugh at me. You ain't fucking... You ain't all laughing at me on the floor, man. You know what I mean? And you're walking out going, ha-ha, you got fucking knocked out, mate. That was a lot of my mentality a lot of the time. Because, like, I boxed a kid called Martin O'Malley in Ireland. Real late-nosed job, American kid, Irish-American kid, supposed to be in the bollocks and that. And I went over there, and the referee didn't know me over there. Kid was beating me, but he wasn't hitting me with any shots that was hurting me. Or he was just busy, you know what I mean? But wasn't hurting me, I was slipping a lot. But the referee didn't know me, didn't know what I was capable of, and the kid weren't hurting me. And the next thing, the ref jumped in, I'm like, what the fuck? And like I say, when I was boxing at certain shows, and the crowd's all there, the ref's on the kid's side, you got the promoter, and I wouldn't let them have the last laugh on me. I'm thinking, you mean, because they're all, you're going to fuck it with the red marker out, so many, but you're going to get fucking knocked out. I'm thinking, mate, you don't know me. I ain't getting knocked out by no one. Especially a kid who's had 5 fights, 5 wins all on points. He ain't knocking me out, no chance.
This is where I was going when I was talking about damage in the book, by the way, is when I've been on some podcasts as a guest in America recently, and they were talking about fighters who've suffered damage, and generally, we were talking about some of the higher profile casualties and guys that deteriorated over time later on, like a Leon Spinks and that kind of stuff. And those guys were saying, oh, well, in your country, you've got guys that have lost 20 straight fights. They should take their license away. Yeah. I'm like, well, you kind of don't really understand how it works over here because it's a different culture, because they don't really have a journeyman culture over there.
No, they don't. It looks like, and it's like Booksmith and Reggie Strickland.
Bruce the Mouse Strauss.
They'd fight in one state one night and drive down the road and fight, but they're only fighting, they're not even fighting boxers. Local tough men, you know what I mean? They're just
fake IDs.
Yeah,
and
throw a pair of gloves on them because they've had a few fights in the bar the night before, but like, they don't understand our journey. Our journeymen would go over there and probably beat some of their good fighters, do you know what I mean? That's the way I look at it.
Yeah, I mean, that whole thing when they say, oh, you should take your license away after 10 fights.
No, because like, one, it's...
After 10 losses.
Who's them 10 fighters you box? All the 10 fighters are crap, yeah? But if you're boxing the kids, 10-0, 5-0, 6-0, and you've been competitive in all them fights, why should they take your license off? If you've been getting knocked out in every one of them fights, then probably, yeah, because you're not up for the job. But if you've gone the distance for all them kids, I don't mean just gone the distance, give them an argument in each round of them fights, why should you? If it would have been the other way around, if you would have been matched against a lesser kid, you'd be getting the win, and... If he was on the home show in the home court, he might have had them wins, but, you know, I don't know. They don't understand what journeyman is over there.
Who hit you the hardest?
Duke McKenzie. Really, did you? A lot of people. Because he hit me with a jab. I always say, like, I was like, oh, remember? He hit me with a jab, and I was like, fuck it, I've never been hit that hard. And he hit me, like, I literally saw it. It was like I always say, it was like someone poking a broom in my face. It was like, bang, a broom handle. And Freitas hit hard as well, you know. But, Paul Lloyd was a sharp puncher. He was better than his record punching was. He was a sharp puncher.
But have you ever felt it hard to deal with the negative comments about being a journeyman? Or is it water off a duck's back?
It can be water off a duck's back, but like I say, I remember once, yeah, I'm talking years ago when I was boxing, and I boxed Vince Sweeney one night down in London. 8-3, took the 5 days, I think even on the afternoon, and it was on Sky or Eurosports and that. And I've gone in the pub the next day, and there's a fucking bunch of idiots in there. And the one kid's going, oh, you was on the telly last night. I was like, yeah, he went, I could have beat that kid. And I went, why was you a boxer? I could have beat that kid. I said, oh, could you? So I fucking banged him out. I'll give him a bang. You know what I mean? Don't try and make out you're a boxer, mate. You know, I thought, you know, that type of, like, it's like me watching the football. I couldn't have fucking scored that goal. Yeah. I couldn't have scored the goal because I'm crap at football. So don't, you know, I said to him, well, was you a boxer by any chance? Like, you done boxing? No. So don't fucking insult my intelligence, mate. Do you know what I mean? Vince Fenn, you weren't a bad kid either. And like, but like, don't make out you could have done what I've done. I've done 8-3s, mate. 24 minutes in the ring fighting. They don't understand it. Because like, anyone can sit and watch. I mean, I even get it now. I watch the boxing. I think, fucking hell, man. They should have done this and that. But I'm a boxer. But like, when it's good, it's the seventh and eighth round. It's fucking tiring work, man. You know, it's hard work, man. People don't realise how fit you got to be.
I mean, you also mentioned at the start there, you talked about booze and fags. Have you smoked all the way through your career?
No. I didn't used to really, I like a drink now, but I used to have a drink. I was young, weren't I, when I was still boxing. And like, looks like, because I've been in prison for so many years that I'm still partying and that. And I used to like great, but I used to train in that. And I never used to really smoke then, but later on in my career, I used to have the old fag when I used to go out that. But like, I smoke now.
What, you'd smoke in the dressing room and just...
No, I wouldn't smoke.
On the way to a fight or afterwards or whatever?
So I'd weigh in and they said you're on six or something. If I was at York, I'd pop out the back and have a fag, do you know what I mean? But...
In your boxing gear?
Yeah.
Gloves
on. No, bandages on. But,
hold this.
But you never saw me puffing and out of breath because, like I say, even though I used to run every single day, I've always been...
Oh, you're so conditioned to doing it.
That's what I mean. Like, when I was a kid, I mean, I used to play rugby. I was in the athletics team. I've always been a good runner and I've always had good lungs on me, do you know what I mean? So I've always been pretty... I've always been fit. I mean, even at work now, people say to me, fucking hell, slow down, man. Because I'm not 100 mile an hour. I don't stop. I'm not... They say to me, I can't fucking believe you're 52 something because I literally... I'll leave the young kids fucking standing because I've always been naturally fit, do you know what I mean, since I was a kid.
What do you miss the most?
About the boxing? I miss going to the gym and especially the gym I was in because like we'd done a lot of things together. We was mates, we were comrades, do you know what I mean? Like, we all looked out for each other and we was all in the same situation. We was all at our backs against the wall that when it comes to a fight. We was always thrown at the deep end and very rare, like, you know, we had a middle and title fight, then it was even Steven, because, like, look, so I won my middle and title fights, and, but I do miss the lads and that of the gym and that. I used to have a good time. I used to look forward to going to the gym, you know, it was never a dread going there. I used to go to the gym, like, three times a week, and, you know, we used to have good banter over there, and go to the shows, we used to have a good laugh and that.
Do you miss the phone calls?
yeah and no. I mean, like I say, I knew it was time to pack it in. I knew it was time. Like, when I had about, like, say, 290, but, like, about 250, I was like, fucking hell. I could see the end of the tunnel coming, you know what I mean?
God, I don't even know how you get through that. If you're thinking that the end is nigh and you've still got another 50 to go, that's astonishing. But
it's like when I had 100 fight. I mean, my 100 fight, it was a late notice fight. I boxed Mark Devaney, who was former British champion up Scotland. That is notice. And people said to me, you're going to retire now? I said, fucking job. I'm just starting. I'm just getting warmed up. I just feel like I was just... getting into it then, do you know what I mean? And it's a mad thing to say, but I just love fighting. I just love competing in the ring and just love
going what to about the show. Like walking through the curtain and the buzz? Do you miss that?
Yeah, I miss that. I used to love that. Especially if it was, I mean, like I said, I think it was my 200th fight. I boxed Baz Carey. Shouldn't have had the fight. My brother had died the week before. And, it was my 200th fight and I wasn't going to go through with it. Ernie Fossey phoned me up and he said, Pete, I understand if you don't want that. I'm going to look after you. And he did look after me. I sent a limousine to come and pick me up. My mates come with me, drove me to Manchester, waited for me. I boxed. Jimmy Lennon Jr. introduced me just before the Hatton fight. But I was there in body, but not in mind because I was upset about my brother and I shouldn't have fought. But I did miss that a lot. I did miss, you know, the introduction and the lights and the music, you know. I mean, they used to say to me, what music you want? Nobby used to say, put fucking Singing in the Rain or something. You know what I mean? But I was never bothered about that, but I used to like fighting in front of a big crowd. I used to like it.
Well, when Brian Nielsen came out to fight Mike Tyson in the park and he came out to The Bright Side of Life.
I did that, yeah.
Yeah, that sounds like a Nobby Nob style move, doesn't it? But, and then in terms of boxing now, are you still in touch? You mentioned Nobby. Are you in touch with any of the lads now?
No, not like so. They all live a different part of the city, so they all live the other side of the city. But I speak to Brian Coleman on Facebook now and again.
Okay.
And Tony Annie used to be like, Cole Taylor, a little message now and again. I saw Cole a couple of years ago. He come down because he knew a mate of mine. We had a drink down the pub down there a couple of years before the COVID and that. And because me and Cole boxed as amateurs together, you see, so I knew Cole.
Quite sure. Well.
And, but no, look, so I've got four grandsons, and looks when they ain't working, I spend a lot of time with them and that. And look, people have asked me, do I want to go back into coaching and things like that? But I haven't got the time because, like, I'd feel selfish to my grandkids because what time I have, I like spending them. I wouldn't want to spend it with other people. So you've got that much knowledge. And someone messaged me not long ago. Like, so when I first finished boxing, I was still involved in it for a bit, like Sid Razak and Ferrari, Earl Johnson, that. But then when my mum became ill and that, I was... boxing just took a back burner for me. And then it was like, family's more important to me and that. And
When you got to 300, obviously you said at 250 you started to see the end was in sight. Yeah. Was there a sense of relief? Like, that's done now. I don't even have... I'm no longer Peter Buckley, the fighter, the journeyman. The new life can begin.
Yeah and no, because I knew it was... Like I said, not many fighters could say, right, I'm going to quit on this night, blah, 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 I'm never boxing again. But I had that luxury of doing that. But the next day when I woke up, it was like, what the fuck am I going to do now? What am I going to do next week? Because I was that used to the phone ringing. I was like, man, the phone ain't going to be ringing next week saying, do you want to fight in Scotland? Do you want to fight in Dublin? Do you want to fight? I knew that that was just finished. So that's why I think still being involved with the box, like taking Sid round and that. Because Sid Razak, he had my mentality, you see. He like, he'd phone me up and say, Pete, I mean, he pulled up one day outside here when I was training Sid that on a Saturday afternoon. Biblion, what? Pete, I've got a fight in Edinburgh. Right, come on, get your stuff. So I've jumped his car, drove him all the way to Edinburgh. He's boxed, the condition was he was on first. He's boxed and we drove all the way back. But that's what I loved about Sid, because he was fearless, he'd fight anybody and he didn't give a fuck. Do you know what I mean?
Also, you were like the, I don't know, best. You were the most iconic journeyman of the period.
Yeah,
probably the most iconic we've had in this country. Mm. So you then, you at the same time, what I'm getting at is you lost your identity because you're no longer Peter Buckley, the journeyman.
That's right. Yeah, did you? Yeah, yeah. That's right. Yeah, exactly that. Yeah.
Was that hard to surrender?
It was a bit, yeah, to be honest, because then you had people like saying, not that. Christian, like, loads of respect for Christian. People say to me, Christian's going to beat your record. I was like, it's not my record. It's if he can beat it, fair play to him. And I actually went in to Christian. I went walked to the ring. I walked for his last fight.
Did you? People, for his 300th?
Yeah, for his 300th. Because like, I was chuffing because he's a real nice kid. And to me, he didn't box the calibre of people I boxed, but he's still done 300 fights and he was always in good nick and he was a nice kid. So I was proud to go and walk the ring with him his last fight. You know what I mean? I was honoured that they asked me to do it. You know, I wouldn't have snubbed him.
Late note is cool. Yeah,
yeah. I wouldn't have dared snubbed him, you know what I mean? Because I would have thought that would be a real insult to him, you know what I mean? And I wouldn't have lowered myself like that. And if he would have beat my record, fair props to him. Because, like, I don't know in that record. Someone could beat it, you know, you don't know.
That's astonishing. 600 fights between the two of you.
Yeah, yeah.
Mental. How proud of you now you've got your story in black and white and you've got it in the book?
I am proud, because like I say, a few people over the years asked me to do a book and there was just talk and this and that. And then there was that book with Mark Turley, The Journeyman. Yes. He asked me to do a chapter in it and I declined and he asked me again. And I was telling him, why don't you do it? I went, because I think I'm more than a chapter in a book. You know, and I actually said so. I said, I'm more than a chapter in a book. And it hit home to me then. I thought, yeah, I'm more than a chapter in a book. Even though I've been in Sweet Fighting Man Melanie Lloyd a few years ago, Melanie... Love her to bitch, you know what I mean? Brilliant writer. And like I said, I met Mel one day, years when I was still boxing. She approached me at a show and she said to me she'd love to put me in a book and do a chapter on that. And she met me in Birmingham City Centre. Me and her had a few points and she's fucking brilliant, she is. And when she writ it, I was chuffed. And then, like I said, I was a chapter in her book, but I thought if we're going to do, you know, I don't want to be a chapter in a journeyman book. And Matthew Macklin, I've done a podcast with him. He phoned me one day and he said, Pete, can you do a podcast? There's a pub just down the road, this Irish pub. His friends own it. And he's got, I said, well, I'm at work, Matt. He said, well, if you can, and I'd finish work and I phoned him, meet me. And we was chatting and blah, blah, and having a good crack at that. And he's gone to me, you know, because he was the king of the journeyman. And I went, oh, and he went, he was king of the journeyman. I was like, yeah, of course, fuck, he was. So when he comes to do a book, and my author said to me, what name? I said, it's got to be King of the Journeyman. He went, well, that's it. Well, Matthew Macklin said it. When he said it, he just struck home. And like, I thought that was a great thought for him to give me that, you know.
Yeah, you must have been so proud when the books came through.
Oh, I was, yeah. Like I say, and, you know, I know my mum was alive. She'd be really proud. And all my family and that who've read it and that. And a lot of people, I'm having a lot of messages off a lot of people saying, like, you know, it's a very honest account. You don't big yourself up to it. You know, it's like, you haven't hidden none of the truths about, like, you growing up as, you know, you was in trouble. You ain't called to, you know, coat it that you wasn't that kind of kid. I was a little bastard. Yeah. I was a little bastard when I was growing up, but I've grown out of it. And, like, if I wouldn't have gone to boxing. I say boxing did save me. I know people say it's an old cliche. Boxing 100% saved me, because if Rocky Lawler wouldn't have knocked my door that Monday afternoon and took me boxing, what would I be doing Monday night? Probably out robbing, I don't know.
Whatever the missus told you to do.
Yeah, but, you know, yeah. But look, so I was young then still. I had no kids. And like, you know, I only got one daughter. I've got one daughter, she's 30. But I've got four grandsons who I think the world of. And, you know, look, I always think if he wouldn't have knocked my door, where would I have been? What would I have gone left? Would I have gone right? And,
but probably not good. Even probably not. Whether it was left or right, probably not a good
probably
choice.
Not good, yeah. But look, so I turned out all right in the end.
It's funny, because when people talk about boxing success stories, they think of the two extremes, don't they? They think of people starting off with nothing and then winding up with everything, yeah, of course, mansions, yeah, and all the rest of it. But boxing saves so many more people.
Yeah, it's more than that. Yeah.
You know, it saves amateur kids.
Yeah, yeah.
It gives them a better life.
Of course it does, yeah, yeah. You know,
it gives them structure, discipline, routine.
Because everyone can't be a champion. But if you can just confidently, look, my oldest grandson, he doesn't do boxing, he does taekwondo. That's his choice. I wouldn't say to him, you're doing boxing. If he went into the boxing, I'd be 100% behind him. But he wants to do taekwondo, and he's been doing it for 2 years now. It's good with it. That's what he does. We drop him there, take it. I used to take him there, but can't go in there now. But, you know, he loves doing that. And whatever all my grandkids want to do, I'd be 100% behind him. Football, darts, cricket, whatever they want to do. I'm not saying they have to do boxing. You know, I'll take them on my hands and that, just to show them how to punch and that. But whatever they want to do, I'll be 100% behind them.
Hypothetical. If someone asks, and you've obviously said that people have asked you to train people, would you train a journeyman or would you train a contender?
Both. It wouldn't matter. Look, I used to train Sid Razak. He was a journeyman. I used to take Kevin McCauley.
Sure, but I was just wondering if there was one that you preferred the look of. You know, if a good contender came to you and said, look, I need to work on my defence and get through fights or whatever, or would you be more interested in slipping back into the culture that you've been in for the last 30 years?
No, look, my nephew used to box. He was very good. And he only did it until he was 16, but he had about six fights. He won them all. Got to the semi-finals of the ABCs or juniors, and I was involved in this amateur club, but I didn't have a trainer's license, but I was training all the kids down there and that. And he lost to a kid from Leeds, in Leeds, and after that I'd left the club for some reasons, and he kept saying to me, oh, I want to get involved in back in the box. So you've got to do it off your own back. You know, I used to get a bus from here to the other side of the city when I was 12, 13. You know, you got to want to do it. If you want to do it bad enough, you're going to do it.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to do it bad enough, you'd do it. But he could have been a good kid, but I couldn't actually be there to show him how to do it all the time. You got to want to do it yourself, you know what I mean?
Sure. Mm. Yeah, Kid Galahad tells a story. I think he had a two, if not three, bus journey to get to the Ingle Gym through Sheffield.
Yeah, that's what it was like me. I used to have to get a bus all the way up to Lydwood, the other side of the city, good 5 miles away. Then I have to walk from the bus about a mile, which was a real rough area. Lydwood was still is now, but back when I was younger, and I used to go up there on my own or with my mate who used to box from as well. But if he didn't go, I'd go on my own. I just love boxing. Yeah, that's what I wanted to do.
Funny, isn't it? You talk about the hardship of taking a bus 5 miles and walking a mile, but wouldn't blink an eye getting in the car and doing 200 miles, and having a scrap and getting back in the car and going back.
Yeah, it didn't bother me. Look, so I used to drive anywhere or jump on the train, planes and automobiles, basically, shut up, man.
No, that's brilliant. But, well, thank you so much for your time. Really pleased we managed to get it done. Recommend anyone to take a look at the book. And I'm really pleased for you that you got one out. I'm pleased that you got your own and all the rest of it, mate. Congratulations. Awesome. And thank you very much for having us.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank King you. Of the Journeyman. Thanks,
cheers,
mate. That was a thoroughly enjoyable time with Peter Buckley up in Birmingham recently. And if you liked it and want to hear more from him, then please check out his new book, Peter Buckley, King of the Journeyman. Peter was often on the road, so it was great to record this in his front room. And he did it not only after a day's graft, but ahead of an early start the following day. So I was extremely grateful for his hospitality and his time. We'll be back next week with promoter Nisa Sauerland. And huge thank you to the sponsors at Hanson Lee Resourcing and Delco Safety Compliance. Hanson Lee Resourcing were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do they find you the best people, but Hanson Lee help you retain them, and you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance, who are a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services to businesses nationwide. They provide expert impartial advice on all aspects of fire health and safety compliance. You can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk.
Thank you very much to the wonderful Peter Buckley. You can find me on social media by searching at Tristix and on Instagram and Twitter. And Boxing Life Stories has its own Facebook page and its own Instagram handle. We'll be back next week.